Over the course of the next 2 weeks or so, you're going to go on a journey back in time. The evidence in this case will take you to the year 1979, specifically 6 days before Christmas, December 19th, 1979. Michelle Martinko was a girl out on the town.
In 1979, 18-year-old Michelle Martinko was in her senior year at Kennedy High School in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And on December 19th, she was headed to a Christmas banquet for her school concert choir at a local hotel.
She had that adorable little rabbit fur coat, and she'd do her hair up in the, what I refer to as the Farrah Fawcett flip, and she'd do her hair makeup. And, you know, wear a pretty dress. And that's very typical of how she'd dress up if she was going out.
Michelle left the banquet and headed to the Westdale Mall to pick up a coat her mother put on layaway for her. When she got there, she ran into a group of fellow students who had also just left.
I think about the time that we did come out of the store, a friend of hers and a friend of his, we did run into them out in the mall.
Michelle had been spotted by her ex-boyfriend, Andy Seidel. Andy says he thought Michelle was at her choir banquet, so he thought it was the perfect time to buy her Christmas present.
Well, Murray and I went down, I don't remember if we went down on the stairs. I think there was an escalator there. I don't remember which route we took, but just went down to her and said, hey, wasn't expecting to see you here. I'm going to go back up and go get your gift. Mm-hmm. Please don't follow me.
Okay. She agreed and told Andy she'd give him a call later that night. Michelle then ran into another friend, Curtis Thomas, who was working at a clothing store. He took his break with Michelle and they went to get a bite to eat upstairs at the food court. But the two ended up talking for too long and he had to get back to his job.
But Michelle said she was going to leave. And so we walked past the store and we kept walking and we turned to the first exit past my store and we walked up to the door and she said she was going to go and I said I had to go, but we were talking like, don't be a stranger, you know.
Michelle bundled up and headed out. Another schoolmate saw Michelle coming out of the exit from the mall and going towards the parking lot. She said she saw Michelle carrying packages in a bag, appearing to be in a hurry. Other people came out at that same time, but Michelle was by herself. An employee who was closing down one of the stores noticed Michelle's car still in the parking lot sometime between 10:30 and 11 p.m. There were few cars left, so it seemed out of place. Around this time, Michelle's mother frantically called her friend Jane.
She asked me if I knew where Michelle was. First she asked me if Michelle was with me. Then did I know where Michelle was? Would I have any idea where Michelle would be?
Jane didn't know. It was a school night and she had gone home early to work on her homework. Michelle's mother called police at 2 a.m. to report her daughter missing. Around 4 a.m., Cedar Rapids police officer James Kincaid found her gold 72 Buick four-door in the mall parking lot with the rear driver's side door unlocked. Dispatchers instructed him to open the door.
Well, she was slashed down. It appeared that there were several stab wounds on her chest. And I remember seeing a laceration on her chin, and there were no signs of life. She was obviously dead.
The officer then radioed for backup. Michelle's body was laying inside of her car, curled into the passenger side seat floorboard, stabbed multiple times and bloodied from her wounds. Crime scene investigators collected evidence. They preserved it, not knowing if anything of value could be found. The case would remain open for the next 39 years.
You will hear that the advancements into science breathed new life into this investigation and provided a glimmer of hope for the investigators, that the answers they sought may lie in the items of physical evidence still remaining from the 1979 crime scene.
Those advances included the capability to test for DNA in bloodstains found on Michelle's black dress and on the gear shift selector in her car. New leads and developments in technology led investigators in 2018 to a pizza joint 45 minutes down the road from the Westdale Mall. There, they found themselves sitting in a booth, staring directly at the possible assailant. That suspect got up and left. Afterwards, investigators took a straw from the glass the target had left behind.
The evidence will show that comparison of the DNA that was able to be obtained from the straw used by the defendant and the suspect male DNA profile from Michelle's dress revealed an outstanding development. For the first time in the investigation of any suspect, the defendant could not be eliminated as a major contributor to this profile.
Who was sitting across from the officers at that pizza parlor? Was it someone Michelle knew, someone she cared about, someone she trusted? Or was it a random individual? After 39 years, her family, friends, and the police finally had the answers to the questions that had evaded them for so long. Michelle Martinko, forever 18. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 107. A head turner, a nice girl, loyal to her friends and boyfriends. Those are just the few of the ways classmate Jane Hansen described Michelle Martinko.
She had good school attendance. She had good attendance at work. Her classmates enjoyed working with her. She had many close friends. She was good at studies and had planned to go to college. She had talked to me about wanting to go to Iowa State and had a particular interest in interior design.
Jane knew Michelle since elementary school, and the two were on their high school's twirling squad together. In their junior year, they performed in the school's production of the Broadway musical, Pippin. Michelle had dated Charles Andy Seidel, who was a year older.
I don't know Andy well. I know of Andy. Michelle dated him for quite a while, which I think shows that she tended to be loyal to guys just as she was loyal to her friends.
After Andy, Michelle dated Michael Wyrick. He also was a year older, and the two knew each other from school and choir. They split while Michael was in his first semester at Iowa State. Michelle's senior year of high school was busy. She kept her days packed with choir practice, the twirling squad, and spending time with her friends. In December 1979, she was getting ready for her winter break and the Christmas holiday. Her school's choir held a banquet on December 19th. Michelle decided to dress up. She blew her hair out, wore a black dress with heels, and of course, her calico rabbit fur coat that was the envy of many. The banquet, held at the Sheraton Hotel in Cedar Rapids, served dinner and dessert. It was a school night, so it wrapped up at about 7:30 p.m. Jane ran into Michelle as they were leaving. She asked Michelle for a ride home since they lived close to each other. Michelle said she wanted to go to the mall to pick up a coat her mom had put on layaway for her. Michelle invited Jane to go with her. Jane, a straight-A student, had homework to do, so she passed on the ride. The Westdale Mall had opened just months before, and it was the place to be in Cedar Rapids before the holidays. Michelle ran into another student who had just left the banquet in the mall's parking lot while she was trying to find a parking spot. About an hour later, she ran into a group of guys inside the mall that she knew from choir, who had also come from the banquet. Todd, Tracy, and Martin. They were waiting to go see a movie later that night. Tracy drove in a limo and invited Michelle to go see it with them. She said no. Michelle told them she was having trouble figuring out which store a coat her mother put on layaway for her was in. She asked Martin for a dime to use at a payphone to call her parents. This was around 8:45 p.m.
Now, how was Michelle acting at the time?
Just frustrated, I think tired. She seemed like it was the end of the day for her, and she was going to head home. And I know she was going to try to contact her mother. It was shortly before 9 o'clock, and she wanted to get the coat before it closed.
While they were standing around, she spotted her ex-boyfriend, Andy Seidel. Andy was 19 years old and living at his parents' house while he attended a community college in Marion, Iowa. He had met Michelle about 3 years prior while roller skating. Michelle had seen him struggling and offered to help him. Later, they went out for pizza.
Oh, she was very outgoing. She was the kind of person that would never afraid to talk to a stranger. She was always willing to help anyone that needed help. It's hard to characterize someone as good and as pure as she was in terms of how she would treat others.
He said they joked around and would read passages from the Bible together. They reached a crossroads when they realized they were growing apart into adulthood. Andy says they dated for a while, but agreed to remain friends. Andy brought his friend Murray to the mall with him to buy Michelle's present. They entered in through the upper level, and out of the corner of Andy's eye, he spotted Michelle's blonde hair and rabbit fur coat on the lower level.
So did you expect to run into her at the mall?
I did not expect to run into her at the mall.
Did you know what kind of gift you were going to get her?
I did. She wanted, I guess back in the late 70s, these lights that had the fiber optic things on the end that changed color. That's what she wanted.
I mean, that's not like a lava lamp or something, right?
No. It was kind of new stuff that was out. Because she was kind of a trendy person. And that was kind of a trendy thing to have, was this light.
Andy and Murray went down the escalator to talk to Michelle. They noticed Michelle had been standing with a couple of people. By the time they reached her, those people were gone. Andy said hi and told her they were there for him to buy her a Christmas present and asked her not to follow them. Michelle asked if it would be okay if she called him later that night. Andy said, sure, why not? Andy went back upstairs to buy the fiber optic light. Michelle next ran into her friend, Curtis Thomas. He says Michelle was smiling as she walked up to him. He asked her to wait just a minute because at the same time, someone walked into the store that he was working at.
A customer came into the store right at that time, and Michelle had walked over to the right side of the store, and she was standing there waiting for me. And I walked up. I dealt with that customer real quick. I was worried that I hadn't locked up the coats. There was a coat rack there that had leather coats on it. Mm-hmm. And there was a cable that went through them. And I had waited on somebody. And the entire time I'm standing there thinking, I didn't lock the coats up.
Okay.
Or did I lock the coats up? And I remember at one point, Michelle thought I was looking at her.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, is this guy standing there going to run off with one of the coats?
He realized the guy wasn't doing anything. He then locked up the coats and walked off with Michelle to take his break. They stopped at the Orange Julius to get a bite to eat. He asked her about a guy she had been seeing. She said she hadn't been dating him anymore and had dated someone else, but he wasn't much better. He said she didn't seem bothered by either of them. Curtis told Michelle he had to get back to his job. They went downstairs and to the side of the mall where his store was. It was very busy by this point. Michelle said she was going to leave. They turned to the exit and told each other not to be a stranger. Curtis said goodbye, and Michelle left. By this time, the mall was about to close. It stayed open until 10 p.m., an hour later, for the holidays. One of Michelle's classmates, who was also working at the mall, was standing just outside the exit, smoking a cigarette. She saw Michelle come out of the door with a group of people, but she couldn't tell if Michelle was with any of them. She then watched Michelle walk towards the parking lot with a bag of packages. The classmate put out her cigarette and went back inside the mall. That's the last time anyone has been known to have seen Michelle alive. After leaving the mall, Andy and Murray went to a strip club. Andy said that turned out to be a dud, so they stopped at a tavern for a beer. Andy dropped Murray off at home and then went back to his own house for the night.
At some point in the evening, Michelle's mom called called my parents' home and wanted to know if I had heard anything from her. And that's why I said, no, I hadn't heard anything. And this had now kind of exceeded that threshold timeline. And when she said she was going to call, but I mean, she isn't going to call. I had no concern at that point until her mom called me.
At around midnight, Michelle's mom called him again. This time, he could tell her mom was very upset and worried that something wasn't right. Andy offered to drive around to look for Michelle. His mom offered to ride with him as a second set of eyes. He checked at a local bar he knew some kids hung out at, but didn't find her there. He looked for her for about an hour before returning home without finding her. Michelle's mother contacted the Cedar Rapids Police Department to report her daughter missing. Around 2 a.m., dispatchers put out a call to locate her. Officer Kincaid was sent to the Westdale Mall at 4 a.m. It was a cold and windy night. The windshield of Michelle's Buick had frosted over. Officer Kincaid walked around it and noticed all of the doors were locked, except he could see that the knob to the rear driver's side door was up. He looked inside to find Michelle dead, her body bloodied with stab wounds. He called for backup, and crime scene investigator Dick White started to look for evidence. The first thing White noticed was Michelle's car was parked slightly askew. It was out of line with the parking spot. He went in through the back door and found a brown shopping bag in the back seat of the vehicle on the floor. Then, in the front right side, he found Michelle. Michelle's body was in the seated position on the floor of the front passenger seat. Her butt was on the floor. Her legs were facing towards the steering wheel, and her knees were under the dash. Her upper torso was leaning back over the bottom part of the seat, and her head rested against the door. She was wearing her fur coat, a black dress, high heels, and pantyhose. Her purse was found on the seat underneath her body. Blood was sprayed throughout the inside of the car and onto the dash, windshield visors, and steering wheel. On the steering wheel, investigators found fibers from her rabbit fur coat. They also found fur in almost all of the controls, the gear shift lever, the turn signals, and the light switches. White used a piece of tape to lift a sample of blood found on the gear shift. While looking for possible fingerprints, he found a zigzag chevron pattern. This pattern was found on the door handles, the steering wheel, the gear shift, the keys, and the light switches. He spoke with detectives and they all agreed it looked like a glove print.
Later in the day, I went to the store, purchased a pair of rubber gloves. They had a similar pattern. Took that back to the station, inked it like it was a fingerprint, and it matched the prints of his finding in the car.
He said the glove print matched household dishwashing gloves, or ones typically found in the kitchen. He also found blood in the zigzag pattern in the gear shift. The outside driver's door handle had the same glove pattern on it, but in dust rather than in blood. The person who killed Michelle was wearing the gloves prior to and during the assault. The glove pattern was found in blood on the steering wheel, the gear shift, the lights, and on the key in the ignition. EMTs removed Michelle's body from the vehicle and took her to the morgue. The vehicle was taken to the Cedar Rapids Police Department by a tow truck to be processed further. At 8 a.m., forensic pathologist Dr. Richard Feister performed an autopsy on Michelle's body. She had 29 sharp edge wounds or incised wounds over her body, including her arms, legs, and hands. She had 11 stab wounds, 7 over her chest, 6 of which went into her lungs, and 4 elsewhere, including her neck. The other wounds were defensive from being sliced with the knife. These were over her arms and hands. Her assailant apparently came down on top of her, stabbing her repeatedly as Michelle put up her hands to fight back. Most of the wounds were horizontal and about 1 inch in length. The knife was said to be at least 4 to 5 inches long. It could have been a double-edged knife or a knife that's curved and comes to a point. As it went in, it created a wound and incised it. Michelle also had one laceration from a blow to her left scalp. Her fatal wound was a stab to the left side of her chest. It went from her front to her back and penetrated so deep it stabbed her aorta. According to the medical examiner, Michelle bled to death. She lost about 2/3 of her blood volume. She died on her back and reportedly had a pooling of blood or posterior levity. Dr. Feister estimated that she died 6 to 10 hours earlier. Many leads and many persons of interest, but no identifiable suspects. In 1979, law enforcement didn't have DNA testing as a tool. Nonetheless, the gear shift blood scrapings and Michelle's dress were preserved. Cedar Rapids police never closed the case. In 1997, investigators sent the evidence to the Iowa State Crime Lab. The lab developed a single source profile from a blood stain on Michelle's dress. A mixed DNA profile was found in the gear shift selector scrapings. In 2002, those items were resubmitted. A DNA analyst determined the source of the blood on the dress was Michelle, but the samples on the gear shift were from multiple people, a male and a female. In 2005, the dress was analyzed again by the same analyst. She found 4 more areas with blood. 3 stains were from Michelle. Another stain had a male profile, one that could only match to 1 in 100 billion individuals. The blood of this individual was also found to be consistent with the profile from the gear shift scrapings. Douglas Larison was the lead investigator at the time and called it a major break in the case.
Well, it was a huge development. It was actually unexpected. And it was really important for a number of reasons. First of all, it confirmed the same identity. It matched with the partial profile in the gear shift selector. And the profile on the dress was also in blood. So from that, it just confirmed my belief that the killer stabbed Michelle to death and cut himself. Probably cut his hand and left his blood at the scene at 2 different locations.
After 26 years, police finally had a profile of the suspect who murdered Michelle. Investigators took samples from more than 160 persons of interest, ex-boyfriends, classmates, family members, all eliminated. The DNA sample was run through the FBI's national database containing more than 1 million people. Still, no hit. So in 2016, a new lead investigator, who was growing impatient by the lack of leads, hired a private lab to further analyze the sample. Parabon Nanolabs is a company based in Virginia that provides DNA phenotyping services for law enforcement organizations. The following is from a stipulation entered into court record. The roots of the company are in bioinformatics. Bioinformatics takes biological information, like DNA, and turns it into what a computer can read, analyzes the data, and produces a raw data file. Snapshot was the forensic DNA analysis service that attempted to predict the physical appearance and ancestry of an unknown person from their DNA. This is known as DNA phenotyping. Snapshot then produces a composite image. Kinship analysis is used to help researchers better predict whether a certain individual or individuals are related to the submitted DNA sample. Genetic genealogy used by Parabon involves taking the raw data from the original DNA phenotyping and uploading it into the public DNA database, GEDmatch. This is done in order to find individuals in the GEDmatch database that share similar DNA to a submitted DNA profile and have that data analyzed by genetic genealogists. Genetic genealogists then compare the amount of DNA two people share to determine their degree of relationship. GEDmatch was founded in 2010 as a free service to help people look for and identify prospective relatives. By comparing the uploaded sample to more than 1 million users who have uploaded their genetic profiles, genetic genealogists can use GEDmatch to identify potential relatives of a submitted DNA sample. The Cedar Rapids Police Department employed Parabon to upload the raw data from the male DNA profile developed from the blood on Michelle Martinko's dress to GEDmatch for kinship analysis and genetic genealogy. On July 19, 2018, Parabon produced a report and provided it to the Cedar Rapids Police Department. The report directed investigators to investigate the descendants of four sets of identified great-grandparents in a particular family tree. Investigator Denlinger used this information to collect DNA samples from descendants of three branches of the family tree, and as a result, the lead he received from Parabon suggested that the investigation be directed towards one of three brothers, Donald Burns, Kenneth Burns, or Jerry Burns, all from Manchester, Iowa. Lead investigator Denlinger and his team started surveilling the brothers in order to covertly collect a discarded piece of DNA from each of them. First, Kenneth Burns.
Followed Kenneth around on one particular day in the fall of 2018. He eventually went and had lunch at a golf course clubhouse, and we went in and had lunch too. Just sat a little ways away from him. We waited for him to finish his lunch. He was drinking out of a glass, had a straw. As soon as he left, we had someone out in the parking lot to confirm that he was leaving. And then we just grabbed the straw.
Investigators wearing rubber gloves put the straw into an evidence bag. Next, they surveilled Donald Burns.
So from Donald Burns, we did a couple different things. Number one, we just sat down the street from his house. On the day we picked to do it, it happened to be trash day. So he had stuck his trash out by the curb for the city to pick up. We grabbed a bag of that, threw it in our trunk, and then we also followed him around and grabbed a glass from him later in the day that he had used. I believe they found the DNA off some of the items and discarded items in his trash.
On October 29th, 2018, they worked to collect DNA from Jerry Burns. They watched as he went to get lunch at the Pizza Ranch in Manchester, Iowa.
We parked at the Pizza Ranch. Myself and Investigator Freeberg and J.D. Smith went in and we sat in the booth next to them. He was with his son at the time.
Two of the investigators sat on one side of the booth to watch Jerry Burns and his son at the next booth over. They watched as he used a straw to drink out of a glass. As soon as he was finished eating, he left with his son in their car. Denlinger took the glass and the straw was placed into a bag and brought back to the police station. Criminalist Michael Schmidt tested the straw at the state laboratory.
At this point, I'd had probably at least 30 people that I already eliminated as being a DNA donor to the stain on the dress. When I came to this straw, and I was making matches at each of the loci that we had results for, it was kind of unbelievable, that the type of technology to get us to this point even existed. It seemed kind of science fiction to me.
And yet, the results were right in front of him. He reported it as a significant break in the case. But the DNA sample from the straw was not a strong one. He told investigators he could give them a better interpretation of the DNA if a known sample from Jerry Burns was submitted. On December 19th, 2018, investigator Denlinger went to Jerry Burns' office to interview him and to collect DNA from a buccal swab. This was the 39th anniversary of Michelle's murder.
Hey, how are you today? Jerry, my name's Matt. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Hey, I'm with the Cedar Rapids Police Department.
Oh, yeah.
This is JD.
Hi.
He's Jerry. Me. Hey, can we chat with you for a second about a case we're working on?
Sure.
It was 11:45 a.m. Jerry Burns was seated at his office desk. His cat was walking across the desk as investigators pulled up their chairs. Investigator Denlinger had a covert camera hidden on his person to record audio and video. The audio was also transmitting to units sitting nearby to listen in on the conversation. Jerry Burns' cat was in the center of the frame during the interview.
We work in the cold case unit down at the Cedar Rapids Police Department, and we're following up on an old case. I don't know if you've heard it in the news at all. It's a homicide that happened at Westdale Mall. Michelle Marteco, is that something you've ever heard of?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you see it in the paper or anything like that?
No.
Long time ago.
Investigator Denlinger gave Burns his business card. He said he had been following up on the Martinko murder case, and Burns's name had come up. Burns says, strange. Investigator Denlinger showed Burns a copy of the composite image of the suspect. It was a white male with blonde hair and blue-green eyes. Investigator Denlinger said people called the police saying Jerry Burns looks like that man.
Boy, it looks a lot different than I look in the mirror.
What's that?
It looks a lot different than I look in the mirror.
Oh, I don't totally disagree with you.
Burns said he heard about the case in the papers a long time ago, but that he never knew Michelle. In 1979, Burns was a 25-year-old John Deere salesman living in Manchester, Iowa. He said he's never lived or worked in Cedar Rapids. He couldn't remember being in Cedar Rapids in 1979, but he has been to the Westdale Mall. He used to go to the mall with his first wife and children during the holidays. They married in 1975, and she reportedly died by suicide in 2008. Burns continued to look at the composite sketch and said he doesn't think he ever looked like the man in the photos, but he would have been good looking if he did.
Ooh. Boy, that's strange, those pictures.
I know.
Do I look like that?
Well, I kind of think you do a little bit.
Investigator Denlinger showed Burns a search warrant for his DNA. He placed a Q-tip into Burns's mouth and swabbed it. Investigator Denlinger told Burns he already knows the DNA will be a match. He asked him for an explanation for why his DNA would be at the crime scene.
How would we get your DNA at the crime scene there, Jerry?
I don't know. Test it, see if it is.
No, we did. How would it be there, Jerry?
I don't know.
What happened that night?
Wait for the test to come back.
Jerry,
I don't think it did.
It did.
I don't think so.
Okay. Jerry, what happened that night?
I don't know. Test it and see what happens.
We're going to test this.
Okay. Go ahead and test it.
We are.
Burns said it was impossible that he would have run into Michelle at the mall that night in 1979. He didn't accidentally get into the wrong car or said hi to a young girl there that wasn't his wife. He said no when asked if there was any conceivable way he could have sat down next to her at the Orange Julius and said hi.
Do you know what today is?
19th of December.
Did you murder someone that night, Jerry?
Test the DNA.
Jerry.
Test the DNA.
Why did this happen, Jerry?
Test the DNA.
What happened?
I don't know. I was not there that night.
You don't know why this happened?
I was not there that night.
Well, we know better than that, Jerry. You know better than that. You know I'm not lying. Okay.
I don't know.
You do know, Jerry.
I don't know what game you play.
You know for a fact I'm not lying about that. Okay? You know for a fact that I'm not lying about that. Okay, that's the one thing we all know.
We don't know that.
We do.
Well, I don't assume you're lying.
You don't assume
You believe what you believe.
Burns continued to deny being there and said he just doesn't remember being there. His brother called him on the phone, and then Burns asked the cops if they had been watching his brother too. They said yes. That's when the recording of the interview ended. Police arrested 63-year-old Jerry Burns on December 19, 2018, exactly 39 years after Michelle Martinko was murdered. Burns was handcuffed and placed into the back of a police cruiser headed for the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Investigator Denlinger sat in the back seat next to him. Using a notepad, Investigator Denlinger read him his Miranda rights. "I gotta assume you thought at some point this would catch up to you," Investigator Denlinger said. Burns didn't respond. "Did you ever see me on the news doing the press conferences about Michelle?" Burns said no. "Jerry, what happened that night?" Burns responded by bringing up his cousin who disappeared in 2013. He speculated that his cousin didn't have any money, wasn't able to buy Christmas presents for his family, and felt like he wasn't wanted by them. He mentioned his other cousin was a suspect in the disappearance. He said his missing cousin had a drinking problem and often took trips to Las Vegas. He figured he would have shown up by now. Investigator Denlinger said the thing he would really like to know is why Michelle's murder happened. "Help me understand what was going through your mind," he said. Burns responded, "I don't recollect." "Is it possible this happened and you don't remember any of it?" Burns said, "I don't know. I'm sure something like that would be possible to block out." Investigator Denlinger asked him to help him understand. Burns responded, "I don't know." "You don't know what was going through your mind?" "I don't know what's happening. I'm confused about everything." Burns was booked into the Linn County Jail on a charge of first-degree murder. He later appeared before a judge and was held in lieu of a $5 million cash bond. He pleaded not guilty on January 29, 2019. Investigators combed through Burns' business computer. On it, they found pornography searches for things such as strangulation, rape, beatings, blonde-haired women, stabbing, and sex with freshly dead persons. Burns hired criminal defense attorney Leon Spies, who filed a motion to suppress this evidence. Spies also requested to have Burns' DNA suppressed, saying police illegally obtained his DNA from that drinking straw and he should have had a lawyer when police questioned him in his office. Prosecutors said he wasn't in custody at the time. Burns claimed he didn't understand his rights and what his options were. Judge Faye Hoover Grind ruled that the timing of the internet activity conducted at least 38 years after Michelle's death and its, quote, unduly prejudicial nature would diminish, if not eliminate, Jerry Burns' right to due process and a fair trial. The DNA evidence, however, would come in. His defense team successfully argued to move the trial from Linn County, claiming possible jurists have been exposed to, quote, pervasive and prejudicial pretrial publicity. Jerry Burns went to trial in February 2020 at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport, Iowa. First Assistant Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks delivered opening statements on behalf of the state.
The evidence will show, instead of a murder driven by greed, retaliation, or knowledge of a victim, or a reason to kill the person, this was a random act of violence committed by a stranger. This will explain, and the evidence will show, this is why no connection was developed between the defendant and Ms. Martinko. This will explain why it took 40 years and DNA to solve. The evidence will show, and this will explain why the defendant was not on the radar of law enforcement. The evidence will show and explain this wasn't an ex, this wasn't a suitor, wasn't anyone she knew. It was the random guy. As a result, the evidence will explain why this crime was and still is shocking.
Defense attorney Leon Spies told the jury not to be shocked by the fact that Jerry Burns' DNA was found at the crime scene. He explained to them how transfer DNA works. He said another person's DNA can be picked up by simply shaking someone's hand or by brushing up against them. He said that those trails of DNA tell us what we are, but they don't necessarily tell us who we are or where we've been.
But the evidence is also going to show that at some stage, this investigation was diverted. It too took a trail. We're going to demonstrate to you that we believe that the diversion of this trail led to investigators believing that Jerry Burns was the killer of Michelle Martinko. In fact, when he was questioned in December of 2018 on the anniversary of Michelle Martinko's death, it should come as no surprise that he could not say where he was on that date in 1979 at a well-traveled mall, a busy commercial area in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
In 1979, Jerry Burns was living in Manchester, Iowa, with his wife and two young children. But according to the defense, it should not come as a surprise that he was unable to identify exactly where he had been. Even though the jury would hear dramatic DNA testimony, he said that evidence is only as accurate as the integrity of the investigation, consistency, and care over the last 40 years. He said it'll be important for the members of the jury to recognize what the DNA statistics mean, and more importantly, what they do not mean.
You're going to hear, and our expert will demonstrate to you, an expert not only on genetic science and genetic investigation, but also on crime scene investigation, that the handling of the evidence, the likelihood of the intersection of trails of complete strangers, demonstrate that the trails do not inevitably lead to Jerry Lynn Burns. Those divergent paths, I repeat, do not inevitably lead to Jerry Lynn Burns.
The defense said scientific paths demonstrate that Burns was not Michelle's killer. But if not Jerry Burns, then who? Prosecutors called a series of witnesses who were close to Michelle or who saw her on the night of her death. They demonstrated how each of these people provided an alibi or were eliminated through DNA. They included Michelle's ex-boyfriends, such as Andy Seidel.
Mr. Seidel, do you know or did you know of any person in December of 1979 with whom Michelle was having some kind of conflict or from whom she feared violence?
No, no one.
During cross-examination, the defense attempted to show possible holes in the investigation and leads that the police failed to follow up on. They showed Andy Seidel a copy of a transcript from an interview he gave to officers in March 1981.
Line five. Did she ever tell you that anyone was ever watching her or following her out of Brooks where she was working? Yes, as a matter of fact, she did. She mentioned that there was someone that had been watching her out there. Did she describe the person? She said, yes, it was the guy.
Excuse me. Sorry, I just want to interpose an objection for anything further than what the question that Mr. Spies asked is hearsay.
at this time.
Is past recollection recorded, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. The objection will be overruled. You can proceed.
Okay, I'm at line.
She said what?
The guy was grotesquely ugly.
Andy told investigators in 1981 that Michelle reported a grotesquely ugly man had been watching her 4 days before she died. At the time, he said she did seem intensely bothered because she was quiet and didn't have a lot to say to him. She didn't mention this concern to him when they ran into each other at the mall. He said he also didn't think of it when he was driving around looking for her later that night. The defense asked Michelle's friend Jane Hansen about what she knew about Michelle's relationship with Andy.
Well, there seemed to be some concern that he just wasn't quite getting over the relationship. But typical teenage love.
And as for Michelle's other ex-boyfriend, the one she more recently dated, the two went to prom together in April 1979. But when Michael Weirich went off to college at Iowa State in the fall, they drifted apart and agreed to be friends. He said he was away at college preparing for exams at the time of the murder.
Mike, through our conversations, were you informed that there was a hair that was found in the vehicle that was traced to you?
Well, I didn't know until very recently, but yes, I do know that that's the case.
And does that surprise you at all?
It doesn't surprise me at all. We spent a lot more time in my car than in her car, but we spent a lot of time in cars.
He said he had been in Michelle's car many times. The defense also asked about his earlier interview with police in 1981.
As I read the interview, you described her as a terrible driver. Really bad.
That could be true. It's been 40 years. There's a lot of time to forget a lot of things.
Okay. So would you acknowledge that at least back then you characterized her as a really bad or terrible driver?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if I said that, I'm sure I meant it back then. I just don't remember.
Okay. Things weren't always peaches and cream between the two of you, were they?
No.
I mean, there was conflicts about other men, who she was seeing, created some confrontations between you and her.
Yes.
Prosecutor Maybanks followed up on redirect with one question.
Mike, based upon your knowledge of Michelle around that time, were you aware of anyone in her life that would wish harm upon her or want to hurt her in any way?
No, not really.
The defense sought to discredit police procedures from 1979 that didn't necessarily meet today's standards. These included the first arriving officer not wearing gloves when he opened the door to Michelle's car, and crime scene investigators packaging Michelle's dress and pantyhose together. And they questioned the integrity of the investigation over the years. When asking now-retired lead investigator Doug Larrison about the 2005 lab results, attorney Spees asked him if he was told by the analyst that she couldn't determine whether the male DNA profile on the gear shift selector came from saliva, mucus, semen, or skin cells. He agreed. Larrison was also told that the blood type was type A, which is a common blood type. Further, Larrison was told that there were too few loci from the male profile for it to be submitted to CODIS. They needed 15 and were only able to extract 11.
Would you expect if the suspect himself or herself cut himself or herself that blood would be throughout the crime scene?
It would depend.
On?
Well, in this case, it seemed that the suspect was wearing gloves. So, to me, it was apparent that the suspect cut through the glove and cut his hand. And the glove probably contained a lot of the blood from his hand.
He agreed that due to the violent nature of the attack, he would expect that Michelle's blood would be on the suspect. Prosecutor Maybanks followed up by asking about the sample from the gear shift. analysts could only definitively say that the victim and suspect profiles were mixed together in blood. It could not be determined if the source was also saliva, mucus, or semen. Each one of the DNA profile points from the gear shift matched each of those from the complete DNA profile on the dress. Next up to the witness stand was the investigator who took over the case after Detective Larrison.
Matt, you've been here the whole trial, but we haven't heard from you yet. So I'm going to have you introduce yourself to the jury in terms of you being a witness in this case. What is your current occupation?
I am a police investigator with the city of Cedar Rapids.
Investigator Matt Denlinger had been sitting next to the prosecution during the entire trial. He said he's been an investigator for 16 years. He was assigned the case in 2015 as Larrison prepared to retire. During the 39 years the case was open, 161 suspects were eliminated. 120 of those were through collecting DNA buccal swabs directly from them. The remainder were confirmed by running through CODIS, or records showing they were in custody at the time of the murder. He explained that their current DNA sample came from the 2005 testing. That's because in 2008, there was a catastrophic flood in which the Cedar River filled the police department's basement evidence room. The package containing the dress was sent to a disaster relief company to dry it out and make sure there was no mold on it. It was then sent back to the police. In June 2016, investigator Denlinger went to retrieve the dress from the evidence room to send the dress to DNA Labs International to try to get another sample from the suspect. The lab was unsuccessful in finding more DNA. It was returned back to the police department. Michelle's black dress was then entered into evidence at trial. Prosecutor Maybanks placed a mannequin with the black dress on it between the tables for the prosecution and the defense, where it sat for the remainder of the trial for the jury to look at. Investigator Denlinger said he had the original DNA sample sent to DNA Labs International to do snapshot testing and to generate a composite photograph. He was able to generate new leads after holding a press conference displaying that composite, but none of those were a match. He went to work in April 2018 using kinship testing and genetic genealogy. He was given the report of four separate grandparents and their family trees.
I started doing research on my own to find living relatives for each branch of the tree. And as soon as I would find one, I would collect DNA from them, send it back to Parabon. I did that a couple of times. And when I would send it back, they would explain, hey, this individual that you found shares no DNA with your suspect. Therefore, you can eliminate that entire branch of the tree and move on to the next one.
He worked to eliminate two. By the time he hit the third branch, he got a hit. He was able to locate a woman named Janice Burns. In August 2018, she agreed to let him collect her DNA. It was sent to Parabon Nanolabs.
Parabon hypothesized that based on the amount of DNA Janice shared with our suspect, that our suspect was likely one of three brothers. And then the names I mentioned, Donald, Jerry, and Kenneth Burns.
What degree of relationship did Parabon hypothesize that Miss Burns had with these brothers?
They said that based upon the amount of DNA that she shared with them, that they were, she was likely first cousins with the suspect.
He then investigated the three brothers, Donald Burns, Kenneth Burns, and Jerry Burns. On cross, the defense took aim first with the sample itself.
Investigator Denninger, throughout the course of your testimony this morning, you have referred to efforts in your investigation to obtain DNA specimens to compare against the DNA specimen of the suspect. You recall that?
Yes.
And in fairness, you were obtaining DNA specimens to compare against the male profile from the spot on the dress identified as F5, right?
Correct.
So this was a suspect, not necessarily the suspect.
Correct.
He said that in 2015, four additional cuttings from Michelle's dress were taken around the spot, F5. No DNA was found on those cuttings. The defense asked about other possible suspects. One was a violent offender who apparently confessed to a fellow inmate, but his DNA was eliminated and he never confessed to police. Investigator Denlinger said he took every lead seriously and investigated them fully. The defense asked if he was able to locate the grotesquely ugly person Michelle thought had been following her.
No, there was no name and no one had anything to specific to follow up on that.
Do you know if any of Ms. Martinko's friends were asked about that worry?
I don't know specifically. I don't know without reviewing all those reports again to see if they were specifically asked about that.
Investigator Denlinger noticed that Jerry Burns had been blinking a lot during his interview at his business. The defense said this was because he has glaucoma and uses medicine in his eyes. Burns ran a powder coating business, which painted metal and put a durable finish on it.
Well, you were asked about scars on Mr. Burns' hands. Did he explain those scars to you?
He said he had lots of scars and he didn't know where they all came from.
In fact, he told you about an accident he had there at the business, didn't he, where his hand got smashed or cut by some equipment?
Yes, he did.
Burns admitted during that interview to going Christmas shopping over the years at Westdale Mall. He said he didn't believe his DNA was there, however, and had no recollection if he was there on the night in question. On redirect, investigator Denlinger said he thought this was all a lie.
Did he indicate to you specifically at any point in time that on December 19th, 1979, he was Christmas shopping at Westdale Mall?
No.
As indicated by the questions you were asked by Mr. Spees, did you and other investigators conduct what you could as far as a comprehensive check of Mr. Burns' background?
We did.
And would that pertain then to kind of what's referred to sometimes as some intelligence, just to figure out what was going on in his life back then?
Yes.
Okay. And through that, were you able to develop any kind of connection between him and Michelle Martinko?
None.
A former cellmate of Burns testified that he spoke to the defendant about the murder. I asked Jerry, did you do the crime? And he said he couldn't talk about it, Michael Allison said. Allison shared a cell with Burns starting in September 2019. He's in jail on federal charges of conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. He has also been previously convicted of fraud and bringing undocumented immigrants into the country. Allison said he and Burns became close and that Burns would sometimes call him son. He said they would often play pinochle and talk. Quote, he had told me if I keep beating him in pinochle, he was going to have to take me to the mall. Allison said that on another occasion, Burns mentioned that nobody was thinking about DNA back then. Prosecutors played a jailhouse video in which Burns can be seen autographing a photo of himself in the newspaper for Allison on January 11, 2020. The defense pointed out that this occurred just days after Allison's own plea agreement was rejected by a judge. The agreement would have sentenced him below federal mandatory minimum guidelines. Allison testified that he's facing 15 to 25 years in prison. Attorney Spees asked if he was using his testimony as a bargaining chip. Allison said he didn't have a cooperation deal. Spees later pointed out that Allison was alone in the jail cell with a box containing Burns' discovery material. The state rested their case and the defense began theirs. They started by calling Dr. Michael Spence, a forensic DNA consultant. He reviewed the case file, and he explained to the jury how trace amounts of DNA can be detected after direct and indirect contact. The defense asked him, knowing that Michelle Martinko attended a banquet at a hotel and was at a shopping mall on the night of her death, would you expect to find other DNA on her clothing?
I think I would expect to find DNA from others on anybody's clothing, as long as they've worn it for any amount of time. And you can even have wash clothing, clothing items that people have worn for, let's say, years, and they're actually washed and dried, and you test those for DNA, and you can have DNA on those as well. Sometimes even the washing or dry cleaning is not going to remove all the DNA. But if you're interacting with other people, there are going to be instances such as the spittle that I accidentally put on this microphone. Just talking to people, you can get DNA on your clothing from that.
Dr. Spence said DNA transfer events occur by touching other people. If they talk around you, if they leave DNA on an item and you come over and sit down next to it or on it. He said that based on scientific studies he has read, it's also possible to transfer DNA from items being bundled together. He noted that after the male DNA profile was located on the dress and gear shift in 2005, investigators did not search other items in the car to see if those also contained male DNA profiles. The defense next asked about a tape lift from blood on the steering wheel.
Well, first of all, as I understand, there was a swabbing collected of that tape lift, and the swabbing showed the positive blood test, similar to Area 5 on the dress. And so there was an indication of blood, but the DNA, there was no DNA typing information that was interpretable there.
Would blood, if it was present on that lift, typically hold DNA?
Well, blood is an extremely rich source of DNA. Within a single drop of blood, you're going to have about 400,000 DNA containing cells. So this is going to be very rich. If you have even 1/2,000th of a drop of blood, if you can wrap your brain around that and imagine that tiny amount, that would still give you enough DNA to get probably a full profile. So it may have been that on that steering wheel tape lift, the blood might have been removed completely by the initial swab to do the presumptive tests.
Prosecutors wanted to clear up a key point of his testimony on cross-examination.
You have not gathered in your investigation any specific facts or any knowledge from the case file or from the proceedings that show that a secondary transfer occurred from Jerry Burns' DNA to Michelle Martinko's dress, correct?
No, I have not.
And so you're not testifying in this case that it's your opinion that the way Jerry Burns' DNA got on her dress was through a secondary transfer?
No, I'm not testifying to that.
The state called their own DNA expert, Paul Bush, to refute the defense's case. Bush is a DNA analyst supervisor in the Iowa State Crime Laboratory. He said that while it's possible for DNA to transfer from a secondary source, he would need a scenario of that occurring to make any conclusion. He said it's more likely for a suspect's DNA to come onto the victim's clothing if there was a struggle and the assailant injured themselves. The judge prohibited him from giving his expert opinion as to how Jerry Burns' blood was found on the items of evidence. It could not be excluded if the DNA came from blood, sweat, saliva, or semen.
Paul, based upon the findings in this case, what is the most scientifically supported theory as to how a DNA profile consistent with that of Jerry Burns to a probability of less than 1 out of 100 billion unrelated individuals would be expected to have the same profile found at F5 location that tested positive upon screening for the presence of blood, how that ended up on Michelle's dress?
The defense objected to the form of this question, but was overruled by the judge. The judge reminded the jury that they are the judges of the facts. It will be up to them to determine the facts of the case that they find credible in rendering a verdict. Bush said he used the information that the assailant likely cut himself during the attack to form his opinion.
A likely explanation would be, again, that we had a single source, a major male profile on that stain F5, that a likely explanation would be that it would have come from blood. Again, I want to reiterate that our laboratory did not test for any other biological fluids in this case, so did not test for saliva, did not test for skin cells, which we can't anyhow do, did not test for semen. But again, based on the information that I have, that would be a likely scenario as to how Mr. Burns, or how that profile that matched Mr. Burns was detected on that stain F5.
The state rested and proceeded to closing arguments. Prosecutor Nick Maybanks laid out how he believes Jerry Burns attacked and killed Michelle Martinko. He said he believes Burns watched her leaving the mall by herself and followed her. He put on gloves so as not to leave behind fingerprints. He said Burns would lament many years later that DNA wasn't a thing in 1979. Michelle got to her back door, unlocked it, and placed her shopping bag in the backseat driver's side. She got into the car and began to start it. Unbeknownst to her, the killer was quickly approaching. He opened her car door, leaving a glove print on the handle.
All of a sudden, the door opens to the car. And she sees there's a man there. The man attacks her. He strikes her with the butt of the handle of the knife in the head, leaving a large bruise that caused internal bleeding. She feels a strike to her head and causes her to fall back on the car seat. She's taken entirely by surprise, but she knows that she has to fight.
Maybanks continued. The assailant struggles to hold her down on her back to get her to submit. He realizes that she has seen him now. She continues to fight for her life. Her fear and terror intensifies, but her adrenaline kicks in. The attacker becomes more aggressive. He drives a knife into her chest, not once, not twice, but multiple times. He knows he must eliminate her. He has a wife, a family, and thinks he can't get caught. Her blood is flying everywhere. She's dying. He realizes he has cut himself. He considers driving her vehicle to another location and starts the ignition, but he knows they'll be searching for her and can't be seen walking back to get his own car. He puts the car back into park and smears his DNA on the gear shift when doing so. He gets out of the front seat, pushes the knob down, locking it. The back door remains open. He leaves to go home to Manchester. And how is Prosecutor Maybanks certain that Jerry Burns is the attacker?
Exhibit 11C1. Match, 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 match. All the way down. Where results could be compared.
Maybanks said there are four key facts for why the jury should find Burns guilty. First, the defendant's DNA was found at two locations at the crime scene. Second, the DNA found came from the defendant's blood. Third, the defendant bled from cutting himself when he repeatedly stabbed Michelle to death. He bled on her and smeared his own blood on the gear shift selector. And fourth, the defendant acted with deliberation, premeditation, specific intent to kill, and malice of forethought. He said Jerry Burns learned to live with his decision, but Michelle Martinko died from his decision. Defense attorney Leon Spies agreed that Michelle was targeted and that her assailant prepared and planned for the attack. But he said Burns was not the attacker. He said that once his DNA was found on the two pieces of evidence, the case was diverted to a path that led to Jerry Burns, but not the path.
First, we cannot conclude that Jerry Burns's blood is the source of the DNA on the dress at spot F5 on the gear shift selector, item I. It cannot be determined based on the testimony from Ms. Sauer, from Mike Peterson, from Mike Schmidt, from Paul Bush, Mike Spence. They're all in agreement that it cannot be said that that is Jerry Burns's blood. We also know that it can't be said how that DNA arrived on F5 or at item I. We know from what we've seen time and time again that the people that we touch, the things that we touch, the things that touch us are transmitters of DNA. All the expert witnesses said they cannot determine when that DNA was arrived on the dress or on the shifter. They can't say how. In the absence of those two big things, there's been a lack and a failure of evidence produced by the prosecution.
He said those two factors raise reasonable doubt, and he asked the jury to find Jerry Burns not guilty. In his rebuttal closing arguments, Prosecutor Maybanks disagreed that the investigation took a divergent turn. He said it followed one path, and that led to the defendant. The DNA showed where Burns was not once, but twice.
But as you heard, there's two sides to every case. You heard ours. And having listened to the defense present their case, I'm thinking of the old Wendy's commercial. The old lady who opens up her hamburger and says, "Where's the beef?" But in this case, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence of this transfer event? Somehow, possibly, at some point in time, he was there with his family? That's nonsense. Nonsense. People were going in and out of that mall every day. It was Christmas. And the only DNA found on her dress and in that vehicle on another occasion was the DNA of Jerry Burns. Are you kidding me?
He said there was no evidence of a transfer event and no evidence of outside contamination. He called Burns's DNA on the gear shift a direct, purposeful transfer and pointed out that there was no evidence of anyone else's DNA at the crime scene.
His DNA is mixed with hers, and the only way that could happen is after she shed blood on her dress, his DNA ended up with it. So you can call whatever you want, but that's his DNA mixed in the blood from her murder.
Maybank said the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Burns was the assailant. The jury was sent out to deliberate. After about 3 hours of deliberation, they reached their verdict.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of the charge of murder in the first degree, dated this 24th day of February, 2020.
Michelle's older sister, Janelle Stonebreaker, spoke to the Law and Crime Trial Network and discussed sitting in the courtroom as that verdict was read.
This chapter is over. We know who did it, and we know a little bit of why, and that it wasn't one of her friends who hated her or had a grudge. It was some impersonal person who had their own issues and killed my sister in this absolutely horrible way. So that part was closure. We still are left with the fact that we've lost my sister. I've lost all of those years that she didn't live, and she had such a bright future, and she was looking forward to college, and we lost all of that.
Jerry Burns faces up to life in prison for Michelle Martinko's murder. He is scheduled to be sentenced later this year. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think. Do you think Jerry Burns murdered Michelle Martinko? What are your thoughts on the DNA evidence? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Jennifer Tintner with the Law and Crime Trial Network. Follow her on Twitter @JenniferTintner. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.